Thank you for having me.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by the Media Watch Group Fair. If you like Counterspin, then please check out Extra, Fair's monthly magazine. Go to fair.org and find out how to subscribe. This show is engineered by Kelly Spivey and co-hosted by Peter Hart. I'm Steve Rendell. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 6 o'clock. Next is Bread and Roses. And tonight, we talk with author and professor Iris Kresno about her new book, Sex After, Women Share How Intimacy Changes as Life Changes. Stay tuned.
KBOO is proud to co-sponsor Tryon Life Community Farms Bloom Festival on Sunday, June 8th. From 2 until 10 p.m. Bloom Festival is filled with live music, activities, local organic food, and performances at the TLC Farm next to the Tryon Creek State Forest, featuring live music by Soul Nectar, Selkies and Cedars, The Dirty Dandelions, Serotone, DJ Carola Mariachi, and many others. There'll be special entertainment by Clown Snot Bombs, performing in the circus act Spaghetti Western. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events. Again, that's Sunday, June 8th from 2 until 10 p.m. at the Tryon Life Community Farm.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Redirect Guide, committed to promoting progressive, regional businesses based upon the values of sustainability, localism, and social justice. Complete directory and resource guide at redirect.com. This KBOO program has also been made possible by Gazelle Natural Fiber Clothing, celebrating 30 years in business with their annual anniversary event, June 6th through June 15th. Kickoff party, Friday, June 6th, 5 to 8 p.m., that's right now, with live music and refreshments. Gazelle is located at the corner of Northeast 41st and Fremont, and at gazellenaturalfiberclothing.com. This KBOO program has also been made possible by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Melhurst University's 5 part-time MBA programs, each designed to provide an educational experience and a transformational journey for those who want to move business forward to change the world around them. Enrolling now for summer and fall terms. Details at merrillhurst.edu. And this KBOO program has also been made possible by a grant from Aladdin Theater, presenting Three Women and the Truth, an evening with Mary Gauthier, Eliza Gilkison, and Lynn Miles, Tuesday, June 24th. Tickets and information for Three Women and the Truth, June 24th, at aladdin-theater.com.
At the dawn of the day, all the darkened kitchens, the mill of gray, all touched by the radiance that the sun discloses. Oh, hear the people singing bread and roses.
Welcome to Bread and Roses. I'm your host, Delphine Crescenzo. Bread and Roses is a collective of women-identified radio activists bringing you feminist news and public affairs programming every Friday at 6 p.m. here on your community radio station, KBOO 90.7 FM. Women have had this forum on KBOO since 1978, that's 35 years. We always welcome new collective members, so if you would like to host, produce, or engineer with us, contact Ani Haynes, KBOO's volunteer manager, at volunteer@kboo.org. You can also find Bread and Roses on the web, kboo.fm/breadandroses. There you can listen to past shows, share comments, or show ideas. And of course, you can also like us on Facebook, KBOO Bread and Roses. Tonight, I play for you a conversation I had with author and professor Iris Cresno about her new book, Sex After. Women share how intimacy changes as life changes. I sat with her a few weeks ago, just before she headed to a book signing event at Powell's Bookstore. Iris is a prolific author of narrative nonfiction books about women's empowerment. She is the author of Surrendering to Motherhood, the New York Times bestseller Surrendering to Marriage, Surrendering to Yourself, and I Am My Mother's Daughter. Her writing has been featured in many national publications, including Parade, The Wall Street Journal, The Washington Post, and the AARP, the magazine. Her latest book, Sex After, is filled with advice with the voices of 150 women, from waitresses to CEOs, ages 20 to 88. Their stories are raw and prescriptive, describing the challenges that can arise in each phase of a woman's life, from navigating the hooking up culture in the 20s to sexuality after pregnancy, midlife malaise, breast cancer, menopause, divorce, widowhood. I started by asking Iris to describe the challenges that women go through throughout their lives. Here is Iris Cresno. Iris, welcome to Bread and Roses.
Thank you so much, Delphine.
So excited to have you. I was wondering if you can start by telling us what are these changes that happen in our lives, in the lives of women as we go through life, physically and emotionally?
Mm-hmm. So I decided with this book that I was going to take women from ages 20 through 95. I usually write about my own generation or have focused on what I call female generational angst, which is baby boom age. But as a college professor and as a mother of four sons in their 20s, I really wanted to identify almost every stage of a woman's sexuality and what types of intimacy challenges she may face throughout the entire female growth cycle. So I say I take women from hooking up in college to this new dating after widowhood in the senior centers. And some people call it, you know, will call me and say, oh, I'm worried that my widowed grandmother is hooking up. but what it means is many of the women who've been married, first of all, women outlive men by several years. In fact, the fastest growing segment of the aging population are women 85 and over, and who are outliving their husbands by several years with elongated fitness. They're not grannies, you know, little old ladies rocking in their rockers. I think they're rocking women. And, you know, many of these women are dating for the first time in 59 years after they've buried a spouse who's the only person they've ever slept with. So one of the most surprising parts about my research for the book Sex After, because sex always comes after something, are the very young and the very old. And I'll talk to you about the very old first. And that is, there's this mythology that post-menopause and post-70 that, you know, women dry up emotionally and physically. And the truth is, people think about sex and are defined by their sexuality till the day they die. And so it was wonderful to discover 81-year-old Patricia, who had nursed a sick husband for 35 years, who was dating an 84-year-old, who was a friend of the family's, recently widowed. And as she put it, you know, Iris, it's not 50 Shades of Grey sex, but it's definitely sexual. And she was effusive like a teenager. So as a 59-year-old, and I know you're in your early 30s, there's hope. You know, it's not that we are going to change and our bodies are going to change, but if you can adapt your mind and your emotions around a changing body, anything is possible in a woman's sexuality.
And from the women that you've spoken with, how do they adapt to those shifts? What are some of the strategies that they use in order to embrace themselves in this new stage of their life?
Well, there's, you know, many stages covered in this book, from sex after college to sex after pregnancy to sex at midlife when you're feeling that 15-year itch to sex after breast cancer, sex after menopause, sex after coming out from a straight marriage, sex after erectile dysfunction, sex after widowhood. So that question would be differently answered for each phase and stage. But I'll tell you about some of my ahas, okay? Mm-hmm. And mostly it's myth busting. And I feel that I write books that are hopeful. I'm not a book, you know, on sex that talks about porn. You know, that's a whole other book. It's a billion-dollar industry. And it's not where I went. I went into bedrooms between people who aren't tuned on to the internet or TV and trying to keep turned on by each other. So one of the myths, I think, in the younger generation, in the 20s, are that a lot of parents are worried that their children in the hooking up culture are having wanton, random sex, and they aren't looking for love or commitment. And they're not tied emotionally. They're just sex. It's just sex. And the truth is, I interviewed 150 women from ages 20 through 94 and dozens of sex therapists, psychologists, OBGYNs, et cetera. And the truth is, Kinsey researchers, that three things are true about the hooking up culture. A, is that most people who are hooking up, which is having random sexual encounters that many times are initiated by a text message, enjoy the adventures of their emerging sexuality. A, that's a fact. B, both men and women in this emerging adulthood population hope that their positive sexual encounters that are good and relational will turn into an emotional relationship, boys and girls. And number three, unfortunately, that women are hurt more than men in these encounters. So while there is a hope for an emotional connection, it's usually the women that maybe are hoping a little harder and getting hurt a little more. So that was a myth. Another myth, you know, I actually did a chapter on sex after infidelity, too. Mm-hmm. So three things are true in those marriages as well. And I've been writing about marriages and relationships for almost 30 years, and I've written six books on this topic. This is my favorite book because I think I really, instead of dancing around the issue and saying, oh, this relationship is good, in the end, it comes down to intimacy.
Yeah.
You know, are you able to stay turned on to your partner emotionally, mentally, and wanting to sleep with them? You know, so infidelity, those marriages and those long-term partnerships go three ways. Number one, the person who cheats comes back home and says, oh my God, I'm so sorry, I've cheated on you. And not only have I cheated on you, but I have fallen in love and I'm leaving you. So that relationship, that happens a lot, okay? B, the cheater is caught, and the cheated upon says, get the hell out of this house. This isn't the first time this has happened, and I can never trust you again. Even if the cheater is on his or her knees and saying, I'll never do this again, the person that was victimized by this says, I can't go on. You've betrayed me. Hmm. The third, and I cover this in the book, the third option, bucket number three, is someone gets caught and they're remorseful, regretful. Maybe they go into sex therapy where they try to, you know, get their minds turned around and they're not going to sleep with a bunch of people. And the person that was cheated upon probably doesn't fully forgive, never forgets, but this couple is able to move on because of their history. They have a family and they work at it. And some of those marriages actually emerge stronger and healthier than before, because hey, it's all in the open then. And I talked to a lot of women actually that got like really great jewelry after infidelity. Although, you know, infidelity is an equal opportunity employer. It's not just the men who might cheat on a relationship. And you know, the question is, and I didn't answer it in my book because there is no answer, is how are we as humans programmed to be monogamous in the first place? You know, it's really a choice that we make, isn't mm-hmm. it? It's a commitment and a choice. So, I mean, I really liked looking at sexuality because it's a primal, ancient force that binds us as humans, right? Mm-hmm. And so I loved doing this book because in a way, we all wonder if someone is having a better sex life, a better relationship. Oh, she's cuter, thinner, better, and she must be sexier. The truth is there's no normal when it comes to our sexuality. The person you think is having a hotter, better, more frequent sex life, for all you know, they could be in separate bedrooms, lying about their sex life, and throwing pots and pans at each other. You know, nobody knows what goes on behind two doors in a person's intimate life. Well, I know because I did this book, but I think everyone who reads this book is going to feel so much more normal about who they are, because normal means your physical and emotional needs match your partner's. And it might be that you don't have sex for a year. I can't tell you how many people I interviewed that haven't had sex for like 5 months. Then they start up again. Something's going on. Someone's stressed. Someone's ill. Someone had a breast removed. Hmm. You know, I go into illness. I really do. I interviewed a woman whose husband came back from Afghanistan without a leg and with post-traumatic stress disorder. You think you have problems? That was a big problem. But they're great. They're great. As she put it, it's only a leg, you know. It's only a leg. Mm-hmm. Breast cancer survivors who got breast reconstruction or chose not to. We are, as women, identified with our breasts, by society, at least. Mm-hmm. So letting go of that. So this is a long-winded answer to your question on how women... How do we deal with shifts and changes in our sexuality and in our physical beings in many different ways?
Mm-hmm. Did you hear from women also how their partners dealt with those changes so how the men in their lives or the partners in their lives actually dealt with the changes mm-hmm. in the women's emotional or physical change stage?
Well, it certainly helps when you're, let's just, you know, start, if you're going through a mastectomy, and I always wonder if I'm pronouncing that right. So if there's any surgeons out there, I'm sorry if I'm mispronouncing that. It sure helps to have a supportive partner. The women I interviewed, one of the men was puzzled and confused about it at first, but you know, in the end, a lot of marriages and partnerships break up because one person cannot deal with the other person's stresses. And getting your body rearranged is certainly a big stress. I mean, there's women who don't want to live with an obese guy with erectile dysfunction either. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, prostate cancer or surgery, that affects a male's ability, you know, erectile ability. And, you know, some people can't deal with that. And you sure know what you have in a relationship if somebody can't deal with your own stresses. And, you know, when we say, when we get married, we say through sickness and through health, till death do us part. And don't get married if you don't really mean that. I mean, I've seen a lot of marriages break up because people can't hold. That's a big promise. It's a huge promise. And it's a promise you need to remake often at every juncture in an intimate relationship.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about the women that you interviewed? How did you meet them? How did you bring up the topic? And what was their reaction? Because sex, and especially women's sexual lives, is very taboo still.
Well, that's a really good question. I've been a journalist for a long time, and I never have problems finding people to interview. But I would say, and I write this in the book, I would say when I wrote my second book, Surrendering to Marriage, 12 years ago, it was hard. I had to, like, give a person a glass of wine and talk to them for a while and really cajole them into telling me what was really going on. But you and I live in a very over-sexualized society right now. Mm-hmm. You know, we have Lena Dunham playing ping pong naked or with a thong on girls. You can't, frontal nudity is all over primetime. And so, and 50 Shades of Grey was a bestseller. So it really, people are much more open than they used to be. I would say that in the book Sex After, women share how intimacy changes as life changes. That's my subhead. Their ability to talk openly about sex has really evolved. I didn't have to pry people open like an oyster during this book. When I asked a question, people gave me an honest answer. Sometimes, and my interviews are not an hour. An hour is a great time, but if you had 12 hours with me, can you imagine?
Yes.
And so I sometimes spend a weekend with somebody. Yeah. And, you know, there's a layer of trust and layer of trust and layer of trust. I think that people were very open, mostly because they wanted to know if it was normal to deal with this. Is it normal that my 41-year-old husband is having erectile problems? Is it normal to feel attracted to someone on Facebook that I used to love? Is it normal, you know, to go through phases of desire and only being 31? Mm-hmm. Is it normal? Is it normal? And so people would tell me their stories, knowing I'd heard almost about everything. And so the range of women, you know, they're white, they're black, they're Christian, they're Jewish, they're Muslim, they're poor, they're rich, they're everybody. They're gay. Some of the women, well, they were in straight marriages, and then they came out. You know, I had a whole chapter on women who, and you know, they, the women who came out after long marriages, their identification varied. Like, a couple of the women were like, I'm definitely realized that I'm gay. But, you know, also some of the women were like, I don't want to be labeled. Don't label me. I still may want to sleep with a man again. And I'm not, right now, I'm in love with a woman. Mm-hmm. And so that was, you know, I think it's just very enlightening to emerge from these stereotypes that we had, that you're either straight or you're gay or you're in love or you're we change a lot over the lifespan. And, you know, we just need to give ourselves a break.
Avec lequel je pourrais jamais être en osmose. Je voulais te dire merci Malik. Tes textes reflètent bien qui je suis. Se mêler de la cité au studio. Mes skin up, su laisser ce que je vaux. J'ai rejoint le front de la rue. Non, moi je suis pas du crew des vendus. Quand ils m'appellent à leur bureau, j'y vais. Ils veulent un truc au locaux pour le succès. Ils proposent de collaborer, mais j'ai choisi le camp des tranchées.
Ceux qui disent oui et ceux qui disent non, mais ceux qui disent oui ont déserté le fond. Il y a ceux qui disent oui et ceux qui disent non. Moi j'ai dit non.
Mon combat, réussir pour l'envoyer là-bas. Quand je parlais de nos projets, papa que j'aime disait Inch'Allah. Son retour au pays s'est bien fait en août, mais son voyage s'est fait froid dans une soute. Rien ne me ramènera, pas même le foutu contrat. Pendant que la course aux richesses nous distrait, chacun de nous passe à côté du vrai. Mon frère fait comme Malcolm pour vivre mieux, ouais. Ne courbe les chines que devant Dieu.
Ceux qui disent oui et ceux qui disent non, mais ceux qui disent oui ouais. Ont déserté le fond. Il y a ceux qui disent oui et ceux qui disent non. Moi j'ai dit non,
yeah. Moi j'ai dit non.
L'identité contre le succès. Je préfère chanter le cœur criblé. J'ai rejoint le mari, ouais. Indivisible, incorruptible.
Sorti de rien avec du vide autour. Avec mes passos, Serval, Kamikaze, ils mourront pas comme Géronimo, Antibar, Télimas, comme Bayard, gaffe au fléau et au flot de photos, lacérant le néant, au-dessus de la porte vers le néant. Je sais quand vous faites que je la ferme, mais ma voix elle est trop voilée de chimère. La voix s'éclaircit quand surgit le chanteau dans la colère. Mon art baigne, saigne des mots, goût de pierre, daigne les dieux, ne pas me faire toucher terre avant la mise en bière. Sabre au clair, je prends position pour la rime danse. Et s'il y a aucune chance de s'en tirer, tant mieux, pas de regret, pas de reflet brisé dans le miroir de l'âme libre. Je manie les verbes comme des armes de géant. Du nectar que l'on trouve parfois dans les larmes. J'ai un contrat, prends ce morceau comme un addenda. Wallen, Shuriken, les tripes approuvent, ouais. Il nous fallait que ça. Si ça le fait, tant mieux. Si tu crois que la gloire peut me changer, ouais. Tu peux te brosser. Les miens savent comment je partirai.
Et ceux qui disent non, et ceux qui disent oui, ont déserté le fond. Il y a ceux qui disent oui, et ceux qui disent non. Moi j'ai dit non.
Las Vegas où on se nique à nous-mêmes. Les costumes spavanes agrippés à leur base. Qu'on se traîne croyant au sésame. Mais le portail reste clos sans devenir beaucoup. Qui se retrouvent au clou et qui s'enfument pour s'enfuir. Et finissent sur les genoux à bout.
Dans des mains comme ça bien,
ouais.
La gorge serrée,
hein.
Chante d'où je viens.
Je vais Ken
Wallen.
Fils,
faut qu'ils comprennent qu'on n'est pas des pour rien.
You're listening to Bread and Roses. I'm Delphine Crescenzo. The song we just finished listening is Ceux qui disent non by Wallen and Shuriken. Tonight I've been playing for you a conversation I had with author and professor Iris Cresno about her new book called Sex After: Women Share How Intimacy Changes as Life Changes. I went on to ask Iris about why is it so hard for our society to talk openly about women's sexuality? What do you think it is that our society is able to have sex everywhere, as you say, you know, definitely prime time, whether it's, you know, commercials or even billboards, etc. And still women have these questions. Is this normal? Mm. I feel that there's a big gap between actually what is you know, the reality of women, the life of women, sexuality of women, as you say, were very much depicted as, you know, breasted women. Why is it that this gap is there, that we can see nudity, but we don't want to talk so much about how women are, and, you know, and sometimes it's not just about power or being empowered through sex, but that women are sexual beings?
Well, I think that we're catching up to our European neighbors in a way, in that, you know, I spend time in Europe and my family is European. I'm a first generation American, and there is a bigger acceptance about sexuality. And our European neighbors for so long have thought that the Americans are Victorian and prudish and in denial because sex is happening here. We just said, oh, not in my home. But I think that we're seeing a real change. We're seeing parents that when I was coming of age, I'm 59 and you know, a hippie in the 70s, our parents thought we were wanton, crazy, you know, sexually obsessed youth. And it's not like they certainly didn't endorse it. And you heard the term filthy, dirty, you know, sex-obsessed hippies a lot. Now, more and more, and I think it's very healthy, you're seeing parents of teenagers and young college kids help them have safe sex, take them for birth control pills, take them, make sure there's rubbers in their, you know, backpacks and stuff. Sex is happening, so we need to make sure our children are having healthy sex, not only physically, but, you know, my big thing, and I think it's layered throughout this entire book, is that we need to teach our sons and daughters and also our aging parents who might be widows and widowers or our divorced friends that letting somebody into your bedroom, like, that's a sacred space, you know, to honor sex and not just let anybody into your sacred space. And so, you know, we're so worried about these young kids hooking up. I think they realize that that's a sacred space, and they know it's very hurtful when they let the wrong person into that sacred space. Mm-hmm. People want someone to stay in that sacred space once they get there, if it's an enjoyable experience. Mm-hmm. So there is a sacredness to intimacy that, you know, I think my book really encourages people to recognize and to honor and to teach those single friends of theirs searching for love through having lots of sex. I mean, that's not how you find love. It's how you find, unfortunately, frustration and disappointment and heartache. You know, I've never interviewed anyone who has a lot of sex that says, wow, this is so great. And maybe, you know, there's someone out there who says, oh, well, she's just wrong. It's really fun to sleep with a different person 5 times a week. It's the flip side. I mean, I even talked to young men, a 31-year-old, I'm thinking of this man I interviewed, who said that he had like 20 different sex partners in the last 2 months or 3 months, and that it just started to feel awful. He said it started to gnaw at my soul. It started to really, really wreck up my mind. And now he's looking for love, looking for love and commitment. You know, it's not so bad. It's not such a bad thing. It's a good thing in a very chaotic and uncertain world to have a stable, you know, cave to crawl into. I mean, I have a marriage of 26 years and 4 children. It's not a perfect marriage. There's been times when I've felt like fleeing my marriage, but I can't tell you that rock of family, there's nothing like it. You know, there's nothing like it. And so in a way, even though I write edgy books, and provocative in my books, and Sex After is full of sex and senior sex and young sex and midlife sex, I believe in old-fashioned love and commitment is really much healthier for your soul. And I think that's the underbelly of the whole book.
Mm-hmm. Would you also say, well, and from the young women that you talked with, did they share it, whether they were influenced by the media and by, you know, the easy sex, you know, even porn culture that exists out there that is, you know, portrayed on TV all over? Did they say that that had an impact? They thought that they had to do that?
Well, I think that it impacts not only young women, it impacts all of us, because the sex portrayed in the media and often in the films, but more and more, it's more normal, you know, it's becoming more normal. What that does for all of us is think that there's something that exists that's called perfect sex, perfect bodies, perfect sex, you know, joint orgasms and perpetual bliss. And so we see this Hollywoodized version of sex, and it makes people feel insecure. And so, yeah, it impacts you. Now, the good thing about Lena Dunham and girls is that Lena Dunham is a little chubby. She's not perfect. She's not, like, gorgeous. She's normal, and she flaunts her imperfect body. So even though I think some of the nudity and scenes are unnecessary, and it's great to put different, more normal, real images. You know, women are a size 10 or 12 or 14. And some men are scrawny and not muscled and have erectile dysfunction. So the over-sexualization, you know, when you watch a show like Homeland or Breaking Bad or Orange is the New Black, which I loved.
It's coming back.
It's coming back. I know. Can't wait. You know, you're seeing like sex and boobs and, or, you know, stuff. And so, and you're wondering, gosh, why aren't I having sex in the chapel like they do in prison? Or why don't I look like the star of Homeland, you know? But those are movie stars, everybody. And those models don't look like that in real life. There's something called airbrushing and Photoshop. And all of us would be stunning and gorgeous. And we are, because we look like real people. So, you know, a lot of that idealized, Hollywoodized sex makes us insecure. And that's why authors like me with wrinkles and gray hair, and like, I'm really, this is me, Copperfield, these are real. You know, this is what we have to do, is we have to say, this is what really happens. I interview real women with real issues and real problems and real body, psychological, and soulful flaws, like all of us. There's no perfect sex because there's no perfect people, right?
Yeah.
And we have to, so, and I do think there is a sense, increased sensitivity to the imperfection of humanity in the media. And I think there's people like me really pushing that forward. And you're seeing women my age on television in sexy roles, and Meryl Streep with Tommy Lee Jones having, you know, going to a marriage therapist. They hadn't had sex for years, and the marriage therapist talking them back into intimacy. So that is real. That is real, that, you know, you're 60 years old or 55 and you've been together for 30 years and, you know, you don't want to just hop each other's bones anymore. But you have to retain and sustain an intimate connection in order for a relationship to endure. You just have to. And it might not be like rock hard stupathons, but it has to be something. And it fades and it comes back and it fades and it comes back. And sometimes it fades and doesn't come back. Some marriages need to end.
I wanted to ask you a little bit about intimate violence, because one in three women, you know, are going to be victims of intimate violence, of sexual violence.
Yeah. So I, interesting, interviewed women who were in abusive relationships, and I don't have a chapter on that in this book, and I've done stories on them in the past, because it turned out to be, for me, its own book. Like you got, I got, there was so much there. I mean, I remember I interviewed a woman from a community in Brooklyn who worked as a health professional in a church. And she shared stories of 11 and 12 year old girls who were being abused by pastors and by their mother's boyfriends. And it just became so wrenching to me that it just became almost its whole book. And so what do I have to say about that? I have to say that when I hear stories from younger women who were abused, and I do hear these stories, and tell me that their mother or a parent in the house either perpetuated that abuse or knew about that abuse, we just can't let that happen. I mean, there's somebody responsible who can say stop. Mm-hmm. And so, I'm speechless. As you know, I've not been speechless throughout this whole interview. But I mean, that type of counseling and that type of leadership, I there's therapists that really do so much better at explaining mm-hmm. that. But I know from my own interviews, just as mm-hmm. a journalist who writes about women's issues and female empowerment, that your empowerment can be robbed when you have been a victim of sexual abuse. It's something that I hear women in their 60s tell me they still think about, you know, rape by an uncle or a mother's boyfriend or a cousin or a sibling that stains their soul for the rest of their life. Mm-hmm. It's big, you know, it's big. Date rape. I hate those articles that blame the women, you know, that slut slamming. And, you know, again, I'm a college professor and I hear a lot of stories and I see a lot of things on bathroom walls mm-hmm. of people who've been victimized. You know, we just have a huge responsibility of older women, and older means anything older than 17, to just teach younger women to be powerful. How do you grab your power as a mm-hmm. woman? How do you grab your power? And here I am on a feminist radio show, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, I was lucky. My father really wanted his daughters to be strong and to have successful careers and to not feel that power was a masculine trait. And, you know, power means that you have a sense of self-esteem. When you have a sense of self-esteem, you have a better shot at success in your personal life and in your professional life. So that's the gift we need to give our young girls, right? And when you give them that gift, they can say, no way, buddy. You know, get the hell away from me. Or learn self-defense. One of the greatest courses I ever took was self-defense. Mm-hmm. You know, grab my neck and it's going to hurt. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I think that's important. Again, I'm the mother of four sons, which is ironic because I'm such a, you know, I would have loved to have a daughter. I don't. I'm sure I'll have great daughter-in-laws. I have lots of jewelry. not that, you know, so write me. In fact, I'd love people to get in touch with me at iriskrasnow.com. It's iriskrasnow.com. I'd love to hear from readers and listeners.
Fine, even if I went bankrupt,
You're listening to Bread and Roses. I'm Delphine Crescenzo. We just finished listening to Alanis Morissette. This was That I Would Be Good. Tonight, I'm playing for you a conversation that I had with author and professor Iris Cresno about her newest book, Sex After: Women Share How Intimacy Changes As Life Changes. And in the final part of the interview, I went on to ask Iris about the knowledge that she passes on to her sons. And as a mother of sons, what is the message that you that you give to your sons? I mean, obviously, they see what it means to have an empowered mother, a mother who feels great about her womanhood and encourages other women to feel empowered that way. But for me, I think that some issues, and we were just talking about intimate violence, some issues are framed as women's issues. But, you know, in sexual assault, it's sometimes women are the one assaulting, but most of the time, men are the one assaulting. And sometimes I feel that that's, you know, a misuse of, this is not a women's issue. It's it's in fact, you know, men doing this a lot of the time. So what that's do you tell your sons?
Well, by example, I mean, all four boys have seen two parents work very, very hard. You know, we have three kids in college at the same time. So they know that feeling purposeful, passionate, and powerful is not a male or female trait. But I think that what I tell my boys, and they know by example, is that in order for a relationship to work, two people need to feel passionate, purposeful, and powerful on their own, and not grab that power and not rely on each other for that power. I mean, although you come together and you're more powerful, you don't ever want anyone to zap your own, you know, to suck up your power to feel powerful. And so I think it's important for them, and so far too, have serious girlfriends. And the women they're with have good work, you know, good heads on their shoulder, and are very independent, very independent. Of course, I also want them to have kids, you know. I also think that there are roles that we have as men and women that may be stereotypical, but that it's okay. You know, I'm a mother of four, and we've talked about, you know, wanting children, that's okay. If you want children, which I did, obviously, and you want to put your career on hold for a while, and you want to be the one who cooks more and babysits more and carpools more, that's not abandoning feminism. You know, there's nothing more powerful we can do as women than refuse to abandon motherhood. And, you know, I've written a lot of, when my first book was called Surrendering to Motherhood, I was on Oprah for that book, and I got a lot of mail from people that said, oh, you're abandoning feminism by quitting your job and staying home with your children. The worst thing we can do as women is judge each other and have these mommy wars. And for me, feminism is about defining your own self and needs by your own individual emotions and not looking to society to define you. So if that impulse is to hop off the career track for a while, if you can afford to, and stay home and raise those children, that's not abandoning feminism. That's embracing feminism. We don't, as women, need to follow this crowd of, quote, feminists. And each of us define who we are differently. A feminist is someone who gets power from their own direction and their own soul and their own emotion and their own needs. And, you know, it's interesting because I interview women of all income brackets. I think women who don't have a lot of money get this more sometimes. You know, they really get it. And I've seen women with very little money have children and leave the workforce for a while and have their mother help, or, you know, they work it out, you know, or have the husband do the day shift and they might work as a nurse at night, you know, that they are able to spend a lot of time with their children. I mean, are they not feminists? What a powerful choice to make. Work two or three jobs in order to spend more time with your children, or alternate, juggle.
Yeah, that was very well said. Thank you for that. I feel that, yeah, very I often know, as women, we get caught up in those expectations, you know, and I think that that it's very important that that all of us are able to define feminism the way we want to define it, but not judge others for their own definition.
Well, women can be really mean to each other. I remember, you know, there's nothing we can do more powerful as women than to not judge each other. And, you know, there are women that I know who have children who work 6 days a week and rarely see those children. And, you know, it would be easy to say they're bad moms, but they love their children fiercely and they're doing what they need to do. They may not need, you know, when my children were little, I really, you know, as a professor, I get my summers off and I was always home by 3 and I could drop them off at school and come get them and they didn't even know I worked. And I just remember thinking that people would say to me, oh, you spend so much time with your children. Your children don't really need you to spend that much time with them. And I would say, I don't know what they need, but I know that I need to spend this time with them. So what's based on your emotional, physical, and spiritual and soulful needs, I have to celebrate you as another woman. I mean, we need to support each other as women.
Yes.
That's where we get our power. Mm-hmm. You know, my girlfriends, I'm just writing an essay on this right now. I have a column in my hometown newspaper on, you know, I love my sons and my husband, but I would die without my girlfriends. You know, for us to be a sisterhood that supports each other. And that's why I love writing these books. I mean, when I wrote this sex book, my sex after, .. she says, that's the title. I loved sitting with my 10 girlfriends in my kitchen and saying, okay, guys, spill. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not going to list you all by name, but just what's going on? And just to be able to tell the truth and to feel empathy, support, mirrored, and normal. Mm-hmm. Oh, I'm going through that too, you know. There's nothing like that sisterhood. Mm-hmm. And the worst thing we've done in the last 20 years is had these mommy wars, like she's a bad mommy because she works all the time. Or she's a, you know, can you imagine just staying home and cooking for your kids all the time? She's, you know, abandoning feminism. We had to stop that. Mm-hmm. In your generation, you know, you can stop that. You can say, you know, we've got a lot of choices as women. And we need to make our own choices based on our own emotional, financial, and physical needs. And I celebrate you. I'm not going to judge you. You're not me.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I pledge to do this.
Yes.
Why did you write the book?
Well, each book spins out of my last book. And my last book was called The Secret Lives of Wives, Women Share What It Really Takes to Stay Married. And I found that when I go around the country talking to the media and talking to women's groups, that the questions I got most of all were about intimacy and change. And so I just respond, and I write for Huffington Post weddings and divorce sections. And the letters I get and the comments I get always inform what my next step is going to be. And I just thought people were really curious about what other people are doing in their relationships. What do you do at 20 years and when you're bored? What do you do when you're pregnant or you've just had a baby and you don't want to go near your spouse? What do you do when you're a widow who's only been with one man the whole life? What do you do when you've been with men your whole life and all of a sudden you decide you want to be with a woman? Help, am I gay? You know, those kind of... So I, and again, I'm not a shrink, but I'm a really thorough journalist. And I think I come up with lots of answers.
What do you hope that women get out of reading this book?
Well, I hope that every woman at every stage gets what she needs to hear. And so if you're, boy, I want to take you on tour with me because your questions are so good. And I mean, it's really, I think about these things. I think about what do I want? Number one, I want everybody to feel hopeful and that if she can do it, I can do it. If she can make her marriage work with a depressed husband who comes back from Afghanistan, missing a leg, and he was an athlete, I can sure make my life work with a husband who snores and, you know, watches hockey all the time. I just want people to have hope, and I want people to feel like, women particularly, to feel not victimized ever, and to follow your gut, and that, God forbid, you're one of the 8 women who's going to lose a breast or have breast cancer, that you will carry on and you will feel feminine. You know, if you go through a divorce, there is sex and love after divorce, and it's sometimes better than anything you've ever had in your life. If you're 82 and healthy and you've lost a beloved husband, you might have the best relationship you've ever had right around the corner. You know, so I just try to tell people at every age and every stage that there's hope, there's intimacy, and that intimacy is crucial. It's crucial. You know, don't put up with starvation of the soul in a relationship. You don't have to.
How about men? Do you hope that men read the book? And what do you think they'll get out of it?
I think if men understood women, they would be a hell of a lot better. And, you know, this is definitely a window into the soul of, you know, the sisterhood. Mm-hmm. And men like my books. I hear from a lot of men. You know, I always hear from people who will write me and say, you know, you don't talk enough about transgendered Native Americans or something, you know, or, you know, that, and I think my books, first of all, covers a lot of different incomes and race and everything. But I think that, you know, every time I would stray into transgenderism or something, I think, gosh, this is another book. Mm-hmm. You know, I think they're a little mainstream, predominantly heterosexual with some gay chapters. And so, you know, I just am what I am. And I think that, but I think all people relate, you know, love is love, whether you're transgendered or black or white or Jewish or gay, you know, that feeling, the universal primal need and desire of anyone I've ever interviewed. And again, I mean, I've been a journalist for more than 30 years, thousands of people I've interviewed about their relationships. I think people want to love and they want to be loved and they want to feel special in the eyes of that lover. And so that's an ancient primal need, whether we're gay, straight, bi, or whatever. You know, people want love. And love doesn't mean random hookups. It doesn't mean a divorce and change of partners every 7 years. Because if it does, at some point you have to land with someone, right? Mm-hmm. I think people don't want to be alone, you know. So we'll probably get some callers that say, I don't want a person, I want my dogs, right? Mm-hmm. This is Portland after all.
Mm-hmm. But it's still love.
It's love. Mm-hmm. It's companionship.
Yeah.
And it's intimate.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Iris Krasno.
Delphine, thank you.
It's been delightful.
Perfect.
You are listening to Bread and Roses. I'm Delphine Crescenzo, and we just finished listening to an interview with author and professor Iris Krasno. To find out more about Iris, you can visit her website, iriskrasno.com. That's iriskrasno.com. Thanks for tuning in to Bread and Roses. We are a collective of women-identified radio activists bringing you feminist news and public affairs programming every Friday at 6 p.m. We always welcome new collective members, so if you are interested and would like to host, produce, or engineer with us, you can contact Ani Haynes, KBOO's volunteer manager. Her email is volunteer@kboo.org. Check us out on the web, kboo.fm/breadandroses, or on Facebook as KBOO Bread and Roses. Have a wonderful week, everyone, and I'm going to leave you with Dark Water Rising. This is Hooked on Your Love.
Good evening. It is 7 o'clock right now, and you are tuning into the end of Bread and Roses, and right now we are going into Hard Knock Radio. So, keep it locked.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Free 'Em All, a benefit to support political prisoners, on Saturday, June 14th at 7 p.m. at the Portland State University Smith Memorial Ballroom. Free 'Em All is an evening of music, dance, spoken word, and political remix featuring David Rovex, international folk singer-songwriter, and emceed by KBOO's own Mike Crenshaw. Again, that's Free 'Em All, a benefit to support political prisoners, on Saturday, June 14th